On November 22, 2010, Counterbalance and the Bretton Woods Project hosted a conference in London on the private sector turn, the increasing shift from public to private funding in development finance, the forms it takes, and what it means for activists and affected people. This podcast gives a brief summary of the proceedings with extracts from each speaker presentation. For full presentations, conference agenda, and more, go to www.counterbalance-eib.org. The morning session outlined the general lay of the land. In 2000, 90% of development bank financing went to public sources, largely developing country governments, and only 10% to the private sector. But by 2007, the proportions were 30-60 and headed for a complete inversion, led by the World Bank's private lending arm, the International Finance Corporation, and the EU's house bank, the European Investment Bank. Now, much of the private turn funding goes not only into private sector-led projects, but into two new and rapidly growing areas, global loans to chains of intermediary banks and investments in private equity and hedge funds. Anders Lustgarten of the Bretton Woods Project opened the conference by hypothesizing reasons for this shift.
The first of which is the desire of donor countries to leverage public funds into more effective aid to capitalize on scarce resources, and that's why we're going to see more of this, because resources are becoming a lot more scarce. But there's also, I think, two more kind of fundamental reasons. The first one of which is that there's a more overt use of multilateral development lending for particular political interests by donor countries. For example, the European Union is engaged in what can really only be described as an energy grab, as the investment in a series of very large energy infrastructure projects that are directly bringing natural gas and oil and electricity from Central Asia, North and Central Africa, all the way to Europe on huge infrastructure projects. And a lot of those are being supported, or will, if they come to fruition, will be supported by development lending. So that's sort of a much more overt attempt by the EU to guarantee energy security. There's also a similar process going on in terms of the expansion of the EU's raw materials agenda. So you've got a more overt interest in donor countries in accessing their own needs. And the third of which is that this is the culmination of 30 years of ideology, in a way. This is the product of what the World Bank has been doing for the last 30 years. If you look at all throughout the 90s, the World Bank systematically reduced its lending to public infrastructure in preparation for privatization, deregulation, liberalization, and therefore the support of private firms. So a lot of the public infrastructure that could have been lent to by development banks in the 80s or early 90s either no longer exists or has been privatized out of the public interest. So in a way, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a tautology that as a result of the move to the private as the answer, there is more and more, there are fewer and fewer options to invest in the public and more momentum towards this private sector turn.
Nuria Molina of European Network on Debt and Development explained the key role of the International Finance Corporation in this transition, noting that while the IFC justifies its interventions as helping small companies with limited access to credit, the reality is quite different.
The short story is the IFC basically supports big multinational companies in OECD countries that have unclear development outcomes. That's the short story. Let me explain a little bit more the long story. We looked at all projects supported by the IFC in the last 2 years. Almost two-thirds of these companies are based. The beneficial owner is from rich countries, from OECD countries. Just 16%, the beneficial owner, it's a domestic company investor in low-income countries. So basically, this is quite staggering figure. We also found, looking at the eight biggest IFC operations, the eight biggest IFC operations account for almost 60% of all the lending and investments of the institution in these last 2 years. So basically, just by this very figure that eight projects account for 60% of the finance, you can already see that there is a preference for very big projects. So that's the second finding. And out of this list of the eight largest projects, we found that only one has beneficial owner in a low-income country, and that seven out of these eight are companies which are listed in stock exchanges, in major stock exchanges. So basically, one would wonder whether companies that are listed in major stock exchanges really are very credit constrained, or are the ones who are most credit constrained and in most need for public support to finance their business.
Stephanie Fried of the Ulu Foundation noted that development banks are moving offshore into opaque intermediary and equity investments, and the damaging effect that is having on bank safeguards and policies.
The theme of upward harmonization has been a very important theme, obviously, throughout the civil society movements. Often what we find is that the financial institutions tend to engage in a race to the bottom, where they point to the other guys' lower standards and say, well, those guys are doing this, we should too. Obviously, the civil society push has been to identify the highest standards and to push upwards towards those standards. Perhaps in response to some of the successes that civil society has had with respect to project finance-oriented safeguards development, we do see a lot of the multilaterals and the bilaterals moving essentially offshore, moving into the use of financial intermediaries, which are far more opaque, much less transparency, very difficult to track and trace. And we suspect with a significant lack of appropriate environmental and social due diligence.
Andrew Watt of the European Trade Union Institute laid out the mechanisms of private equity investment, concluding that while rates of return and value addition are excellent for investors, their social impacts are highly damaging and a wave of bailouts may be around the corner.
It's important from a worker's point of view because that, you know, over time, industrial relations, traditions and practices build up within a company. And of course, once private equity comes in, these sort of longer term, often implicit contracts between management and labor tend to get thrown in the waste paper bin. Prime concerns were about, from the union point of view, about working conditions and employment security. A second concern was about collective bargaining institutions and the rights of workers to participate in decision-making in the companies. So subsidiary risks and concerns about taxation, some more sort of public finance point of view.
Nick Hildyard of the Corner House concluded that development finance is being revolutionized. The volume of private sector investment in the South is nearly 10 times that of China, the West's favorite bugbear, and will only rise as India and China seek major equity investment in future projects. Nick concluded by listing 10 reasons why private equity is incompatible with development.
First of all, it's just on the clean tech sector. Most of the investments are predicated on getting money via carbon trading and clean development mechanism, both of which stink. Second, there's a very, very high failure rate for these investments. 70% of private equity fails. Climate finance is something that is too important for all of us to be allowed to fail. Thirdly, there are absolutely no standards. And bear in mind, these clean tech projects aren't just because they're green, devoid of all the social and environmental risks that come with most projects. They involve taking over land, etc., etc., etc. Fourthly, these companies would put 17 minimum percent rates of return on investment. That's going to exclude the poor because of the high tariffs that are going to be charged to make that sort of money. Fifthly, it's fad finance. There are 10,000 clean tech startup firms in the Beijing area alone. People are already talking about the clean tech bubble about to burst. The solar bubble in India is about to burst. And when they burst, these companies are just going to divest as quickly as they possibly can, with all the consequences of that boom and bust cycle that we've seen over here. Sixthly, capital flows. At these IPOs, massive sums come in from abroad. Massive funds. and they perhaps 90% of them go in and out having made a profit. With the Coal India IPO, it was, you know, these funds were going in and out for about 4 or 5 days. A lot of the money, by the way, came from the money coming in from America was money that was arose from quantitative easing, the latest round of quantitative easing, which is, you know, ironic. so you've got the danger of speculative capital and all of that required means. Seventh, these are, there's an element of cultural entryism with these firms. These private equity firms aren't just bringing money. They're bringing an approach to capital, to capitalism, approach to management that is extremely ruthless. Eighth, financialization. As the state withdraws from a lot of sectors that it used to be involved in, so the private sector has to raise the money and keep on recycling that money. And the only way they can do that is through, you know, offsetting their risks through these complex derivatives like CDOs and CDSs and so on, and by securitizing. And we all know where that's brought us. Ninth, control. Clean tech, the new generation of renewables, offers the real possibility of communities having some control over their energy supply. Do you actually want it to be in the hands of private equity? Do you want these projects to come from the communities with community support, or be imposed and controlled by private equity, often with investors entirely in the north who may or may not withdraw their investments? And tenth, all of them use tax havens, or most of them use tax havens. And that means a massive drainage of capital and that could be used within the countries. And remember that in Africa, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, 90% of infrastructure is still funded by the state via taxation. So for those reasons, I would be extremely wary of embracing this type of development finance, even where it looks as if it is actually supporting things that we would support. And I think this all raises major challenges for how we work on these issues. If you look at MDB finance that's going into private equity, it is minute, absolutely minute, compared with the amounts of money that are going in from pension funds, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, high net individuals, and endowments.
The day's afternoon sessions focus more specifically on the two newest mechanisms of private investment, financial intermediaries and private equity, which between them receive 50% of IFC new investment and 75% of EIB investment in Africa in 2009 alone. John Christensen of Tax Justice Network kicked off the debate on intermediaries by defining what they are and how they work, noting in the process that current flows tend to focus on rent-seeking behavior.
Far too much of it is going towards mergers and acquisitions, that is, buying up existing companies, in many cases asset stripping them, shifting their licenses and their patents and so on offshore, leveraging them with debt, typically from offshore subsidiaries, so you can transfer price their earnings out to often to tax haven economies. A huge amount of investment goes into other types of rent-seeking activity, including commercial property, land purchases, activities like that, which are essentially seeking unearned incomes rather than developing new products, new services, and genuinely investing in startup activity.
Isabella Besedova of Bankwatch told the tale of the small and medium-sized enterprise bailout in 2008, orchestrated by the European Investment Bank after the financial crisis, and the bank's failure to get the money where it was supposed to go.
The EIB, again coming back to that press release, put out some numbers recently, and it said that 50,000 people, or 50,000 businesses were reached in 2009. Now, there's almost 21 million businesses in Europe. So actually, that comes out at a penetration rate of about 0.25%. So you would be asking, what's happened with all of this money? And I guess the answer is, it's unfortunately still, a lot of it is sitting with the banks. The Banks are given up to 2 years to disperse. And really, I mean, this is money that's needed within the real economy to drive and stimulate the economy. And what we're finding is, because the capital markets had dried up so much, it became very attractive for the banks to simply hang on to this and to, I guess, to a large part, take their time with dispersing the funds. If you're given up to 2 years, maybe more with an extension, why would you disperse it faster? If you're short of liquidity and capital, and you have this for up to 2 years, of course, it's quite tempting to sort of, you know, hang on to it as much as possible. Of course, there were tightened sort of, you know, conditions in those days, and the banks were sort of, you know, really picking and choosing their customers, which is true. However, what we found was that a lot of loans were untouched.
Antonio Tricarico of CRBM in Italy followed up with a litany of EIB failures in investing in intermediaries in Africa.
Now, on transparency, we basically got to the conclusion that it's impossible to know. Our research actually tried to go the other way around, a little bit what Nick was exposing this morning. We tried to first approach the companies, or the funds, or the banks, the intermediaries, and ask them how they were handling that before, of course, asking also the EIB. And in practical terms, the EIB does not disclose the information about how the global loans have been used, so basically how that on lending in the end happened and what are the ultimate beneficiaries. This is not possible for commercial confidentiality, apparently. There is a very strict definition of this, and also I would say an obsession in this regard. They simply release when the full so-called credit line or global loan is disbursed. They can release aggregate figures in terms of the sectors which have been supported and the number of allocations. Of course, you can understand this is extremely difficult in terms of giving a clear picture of reality. In terms of the due diligence, basically, these partners are fully delegated to carry out the due diligence of the project in terms of social, environmental, development impacts. And we regard this as a black hole in the sense that that's where the risk is that even the existing policies can be further watered down in reality. It's important to remind that the EIB encouraged to adopt EU standards when operating outside the EU, but the EU standards are just a benchmark. Now, given that it's impossible to know at the time of approval of a credit line what are the specific projects which will get supported in the end, the logic of the bank is to say, well, we assess the capacity and the record of the financial intermediary in carrying out a good job, and we trust them. That's where they're trusted and experienced. And apart of very few exceptions where a specific EIA requesting the bank might somehow have a say, basically there is a full delegation once that this green light is given. Now, most of these global loans, they still have operations which in reality are supported in heavy impact sectors, and that's where the problem comes.
As a respondent, Dennis Long of European Bank for Reconstruction and Development wrapped up the first afternoon session with a short insider's perspective on why development banks began using financial intermediaries and some of the unexpected consequences.
Several things began to happen. First, a lot of those local banks ended up getting bought up by, certainly in our region, Eastern Europe, by international banks, Raiffeisen being probably the biggest. So even though they had local branch offices and sometimes even kept the name, ownership shifted to Western Europe. Then another thing sort of happened. If you're a banker, either at EBRD, which I'm not a banker, or at a local bank, and you've got a volume target, which unfortunately in the recent crisis has only accelerated, there's a natural tendency to want to move to larger deals, because larger deals for the same amount of time, you can meet your target and make larger profits. So a lot of these loans went from small loans to small lenders to increasingly larger loans. Now, we've used the term in the last presentation, SMEs. I think most of you, when you hear that, you focus on the S, the small companies. Well, the M, medium-sized enterprises. So how big is an SME? On the IFC rule, an SME loan can be up to $10 million. That's the IFC portion of it. So the company might put in $30 million. So we're looking at a $30 or $40 million project into a $200 or $300, $500 million company operation. So the concept of SME that I think a lot of people thought about and originally envisioned when we went down this path has changed.
The final session on private equity was led off by an invaluable insider's perspective from private equity attorney John Crutcher, who argued that private equity is fundamentally neutral though not designed for development, and that its impacts depend on oversight, research, and due diligence.
So in this case, when you're setting up and when you're arguing amongst those potential limited partners, there are going to be a lot of differences, in particular with something like a development-oriented group. Development-oriented group has an agenda in addition to making money. It's very easy when everyone just wants to make money. It's a remarkably fungible commodity. But if you have, well, we are really interested in achieving this goal, or we are really interested in achieving these things in this area, and we specifically want to avoid these things, you're going to get quite a lot of, it's going to be quite a matrix when it's not a pure money play. But that's the negotiation, and so the DFI has to get in the room and do the talking. And if they can't get their provisions in, or if they aren't comfortable with the provisions they got plus an opt-out, then they walk away. I think there's been a problem where they've just written the check, and then they see their money going somewhere that they never wanted it to go to. And I'm going to continue to argue the active role for the DFI. There's a lot to do after writing the check. The DFI should look at what's proposed and think about it and think, oh, well, do we have a particular sensitivity in this area? Maybe we do, because DFI is one of several LPs, so the management company can't anticipate everything. They are not a pure proxy for the DFI. So if the DFI has particular sensitivity, they need to write this requirement into the partnership agreement that when you have a proposal, you let us know. And we're going to put together a supplemental diligence list, and you're going to get your guys and send them in there, not just call the guy and say, is this okay? Send them in there, figure it out. And if you can't figure it out, then quantify that risk, and we're going to bake it into the agreement.
Independent researcher from Nigeria, Dotun Aloko, in contrast, argued that private equity fuels corruption in developing countries, talking us through the case of Emerging Capital Partners, a Texan hedge fund backed by European Investment Bank, instrumental in a money laundering scandal costing hundreds of millions of dollars.
Back in 2007, there was a raging debate about corruption and corruption at the government level. The Financial Crimes Commission that was in the process of prosecuting some corrupt government officials put into the public domain the reasons why they were attempting to prosecute these people. And lo and behold, some private equity funds were mentioned. I looked into those funds and found that they were sponsored by DFIs. If we start from the company there called Notori, that is one of the companies that when the EFCC made public their reasons for prosecuting this corrupt pair, that is one of the companies that they named for their involvement in his corrupt activities. Now, one would naturally have expected that a fund manager acting on behalf of development finance institutions coming into Nigeria, a company that is a country that is known to be corrupt, and you're therefore expected to carry out extended due diligence, the purpose of which is to establish the true identity of the beneficial owners behind these companies, can manage to invest in all these companies without realizing that these individuals named here are key associates of the gentleman that Antonio displayed the picture of the money in his found in his compound somewhere.
Richard Brooks of Private Eye, a longtime observer of the UK development group CDC, which also invested in Emerging Capital Partners, declared himself cynical about the possibility of using private equity for development based on several examples from CDC's portfolio.
So investments in agriculture all but disappeared. Investments in infrastructure fell by 70% or so over a period of 20 years. And we found investments in banking, including those, the banks that Doton mentioned in Nigeria, which incidentally led to the Nigerian taxpayer bailing out the British taxpayer, which was a bit of an inversion of what development should be about. So it ended up with money in those kind of investments, mining, shopping centres. I visited one of the shopping centres a couple of months ago in Ghana, the Accra Mall, which in which CDC put £16 million, $16 million, tax-free. It enjoys a five-year tax holiday, and it's very successful. You know, if you're looking for a Nike Brazil shirt for $50, then you can find one there. But most people in Ghana couldn't, and several investment opportunities in Ghana were passed up as a result.
In conclusion, most participants said that the conference was a tremendous success in alerting a range of people with different experiences in development to the reality and implications of this privatization and financialization of development, and really set the boundaries of a lot of new NGO work and collaborations. So to find out more, please contact Anders Lustgarten with the Bretton Woods Project or Desislava Stoyanova, coordinator of the Counterbalance Coalition.